first time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Himati and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president. While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country we launch an attack to a citizen, a bona fide citizen of an innocent citizen to his house is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the federal high court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all US sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principal character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homar Ezgi, Vienna.
Iran has unveiled a book titled Golan. The book discusses the importance of the Golan Heights, from where Israel monitors developments in Syria after its occupation, so it does not tend to lose its control.
Speaking at the unveiling ceremony, the Syrian ambassador to Tehran said that to Syrians, the Golan Heights is as important as the Gaza Strip.
We thank and appreciate the publication of such an important book on the Golan Heights. We thank the author of the book, the Palestine Committee of Iran's presidential office, as well as Iraq's Al-Nujaba Islamic Resistance Movement for publishing the book on the anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights, especially when Israel prevented Syrian inhabitants of the Golan Heights to take part in the election. Syria has always stood by Palestine, and the enemy knows that for us every single inch of our homeland is as important as the whole country, and we are always prepared to pay any price to protect our territorial integrity.
This book is the result of my research and studies on the importance of the Golan Heights for the Zionist regime's national security strategy. This book has two parts. The first part discusses the ideology of occupation, and the second part talks about the military and non-military specifications of the Golan region, because the Golan Heights overlook the four surrounding countries of Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and even Jordan, so it has a special geopolitical importance for Israel.
Meanwhile, Palestinian ambassador to Tehran, for his part, thanked Islamic Republic of Iran for publishing such a significant book, saying Syria has always stood by Palestine.
Syria has paid a heavy price for supporting Palestine. We share a common history. The 1965 revolution in Palestine was generated with the support of Syria, for which Syria came under numerous Israeli attacks. Syrians have offered many martyrs on this path, and we believe that they will finally liberate the Golan Heights from the Israeli occupation.
The Golan Heights has a special geopolitical, strategic, economic, military, and tourism importance for Israel. Therefore, the occupation of the Golan has continued the survival of the regime. But today, the resistance forces have become so powerful that Israel, which claims to have the world's fourth largest army, has surrendered the Gaza War.
In 1967, Israel waged a full-scale war against Arab territories, during which it occupied a large swathe of Golan and annexed it 4 years later, a move never recognized by the international community. In 1973, another war broke out, and a year later, a UN-brokered ceasefire came into force, according to which Tel Aviv and Damascus agreed to separate their troops and create a buffer zone in the Heights. But Israel has over the past decades built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. This comes as the United Nations has emphasized Syria's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this as the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters. advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden.
This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. To avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, and that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Maro Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meat through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
The Justice Department will tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and staff. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Charlie Savage. The piece is titled, Justice Department Will Toughen Rules for Seizing Lawmakers' Data, Garland says. Justice Department may tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and their staff. Later in the day, Merrick Garland also met with leaders of the New York Times, CNN, and the Washington Post, after the disclosure of the Trump Justice Department had secretly seized phone records of reporters at each outlet in search of their sources. President Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland have said that prosecutors will no longer be permitted to use that tactic. The two events underscored how recent revelations displaying the power of prosecutors to secretly seize records from phone and technology companies for leak investigations have become a major political headache for the Biden-era Justice Department, even as many questions remain about the context. David McGraw, a New York Times newsroom lawyer who attended the meeting with its publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, portrayed the discussion about restricting the ability of leak hunters to go after reporters' data as positive. Under an agreement, news executives were permitted to disclose what they said, but Attorney General Merrick Garland's responses were off the record. In today's meeting, we once again sought a full accounting of what happened and requested that the Department of Justice codify that it will no longer seize journalists' records during leak investigations, Mr. Sulzberger said in a statement. We were encouraged by Attorney General Merrick Garland's statements, but we will continue to push until our concerns are addressed. The meeting came hours after Attorney General Merrick Garland had addressed the political uproar over the subpoena for congressional information, which the New York Times reported last week. He said he had asked his deputy, Lisa O'Monico, to review and toughen the department's existing policies for obtaining records of the legislative branch, noting that she was already working on surfacing potentially problematic matters deserving high-level review. Mr. Garland added, consistent with our commitment to the rule of law, we must ensure that full weight is accorded to separation of powers concerns moving forward. The announcement came as John C. Demers, the Trump administration official who leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, which oversees leak investigations, told his staff that he would step down at the end of next week. On Sunday, Democratic lawmakers had called for John C. Demers to testify about a subpoena that swept in congressional information, along with the former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and the former Attorney Generals Jeff Sessions and William Barr. But on Monday, 14th of June, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, denounced those calls, saying that An investigation by the Justice Department's Independent Inspector General was sufficient. By calling for a congressional inquiry, he said, top Democrats gave in to the urge to pick at the scab of politically motivated investigations. The Department of Justice is empowered to investigate criminal conduct by members of Congress and their staff. Necessarily, this sort of investigation is subject to strict procedural protections, Mitch McConnell said. The department's inspector general is fully equipped to determine whether these procedures were followed. I'm confident that the existing inquiry will uncover the truth. He also said that it was particularly disappointing that our colleagues are attacking Bill Barr over investigative decisions that occurred when he wasn't there yet. The grand jury subpoena that swept up congressional information was dated February 2018, when Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein were still the top two officials in the Justice Department. Still, after William Barr was sworn in the following year, the New York Times has reported, he brought in a trusted prosecutor with little relevant experience to help reinvigorate several leaked cases, including that involved congressional Democrats and their staff. Eventually, it was shut down without charges. Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the number two Democrat who has supported calling for former Attorney General to testify, pushed back at Mitch McConnell's suggestion that there was nothing amiss, asking, how would he know that? Senator Richard Durbin, who is also the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, sent a letter signed by the other 10 Democrats on that panel to Merrick Garland on Monday, asking for a copy of the subpoena and internal emails and other records related to it, and posing questions about its basis and purpose. Subpoena appears to have been part of a leak investigation that centered on a Democratic aide on the House Intelligence Committee. The New York Times has previously reported that it's listed 109 phone numbers and email addresses and sought account data linked to those numbers. Two lawmakers, Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both Democrats of California, were among those whose account information Apple turned over, along with aides and a relative of Adam Schiff's. The broad subpoena appears to have been an example of a common technique investigators use when they obtain the communications records of a target. By subpoenaing electronic communication providers for any account information linked to those phone numbers or email addresses, they can identify the people with whom the target interacted. For example, many people own a smartphone that uses either Apple or Google's operating systems and register their phone numbers with one of those companies when setting up their devices. Those accounts may also have their names, addresses, email addresses, data about the phone and computer hardware they use to access the account, and sometimes even credit card numbers. While the controversies over secret Trump-era seizures of data about reporters and about lawmakers and their staff have partly emerged, there is an important difference. The phone data seized about reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN centered on a type of metadata, calling logs, that reveals whom people have spoken with. The Justice Department also carried out a related legal fight over a court order it obtained for logs of the reporters' emails, which can also reveal social contacts that spilled into the Biden era and included gag orders imposed on executives at the New York Times and CNN. By contrast, there is no sign that the subpoena to Apple could have provided investigators with the type of metadata that would offer a systematic look at the lawmakers' contacts with other people. according to law enforcement officials, prosecutors cannot use a grand jury subpoena to obtain email logs. Instead, they obtain court orders if they want to seize the information logging senders and recipients of emails and other types of electronic messages. Apple, which is not a phone company and does not generate traditional calling logs, has said it turned over only account subscriber information in response to the grand jury and that it did not provide any content such as emails or pictures.
The debate.
The reign of Israel's longest serving prime minister has come to an end. Prime Minister Netanyahu is out. Naftali Bennett is in. Who is Naftali Bennett? What changes, if any, will we see in Israel, especially its foreign policy? And will it make a difference in the lives of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip or in the occupied territories? In this edition of the debate, we will look at Naftali Bennett's past service, especially in the role of Minister of Military Affairs, in which he prides himself on how gruesomely it handled Palestinians.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yisha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be.
As a prime minister, Bennett will continue to act what he was doing as an opposition leader. We will be witnessing the same policies such as Israeli expansionist agenda, its stringing of settlements and aggression on the Gaza Strip. And those policies will lead to more tensions and violence across the region.
Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against, and one abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, author and researcher Daniel Yejic joins us from Beirut, and we have political analyst Tariq Tahboub, who joins us from Amman. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me go to our guest first in Amman, Tariq, and ask you, who is Naftali Bennett? What differences does he have with the previous prime minister or prime ministers, should I say?
Well, Naftali Bennett has been known to the Palestinians, and he has been the former chief of staff of Netanyahu, and his military secretary during Netanyahu's prime minister. He's more extremist. There is nothing right about him. Right-wing doesn't apply. Right-wing even to a wing doesn't apply. They are most extremist, egomaniacs, extortionists, ethnic cleansing, and land-grabbing politicians. He is more extreme and dangerous than Benjamin Netanyahu. We are pleased to see Netanyahu leave, hopefully for prison, because he's a corrupt politician as well as a war criminal. But that joy was marred by getting what was more of a war criminal. He is on record saying that he has killed many Arabs and many Palestinians, and he has no qualms about it. His right-hand lady is Shakid, Aylat Shakid, I think. Yeah, and she's more extreme than him. She has called for the genocide of Palestinian babies and killing of Palestinian mothers because they give birth to snakes. This is the kind of politicians that this genocidal ethnic cleansing occupation is being led by.
Uh-huh. Well, Daniel Yejic, maybe those are the qualifications to make you prime minister when it comes to that position in Israel. Some of the things that our guests there mentioned. I mean, what are your thoughts on this, especially the fact that you have a coalition that, based on the amount of influence it has in decision making, is very fragile in its structure?
I agree with that. It is absolutely the qualification one needs to have to be the prime minister of the Zionist entity, which is a colonial project that is based on the ethnic cleansing and genocidal erasure of Palestinians from their land. And I think Bennett can be seen as an epitome of this very project. He is someone who has advocated the expansion of settlements, annexation, has bragged about how many Arabs he killed in his life, and that he's proud about that, and saw no problem in that. So in many ways, he symbolizes the very very violent core of the Zionist project. And then if we look at the political spectrum of the Zionist entity, there are different realizations of Zionism and different parties, but at the core of it, the structure, these are all politicians who support the expansion of settler colonialism in Palestine and even beyond. And I think Bennett is another example of someone who has infiltrated into Lebanon on several occasions, has been responsible, has been an officer during the brutal and illegal Israeli military occupation of South Lebanon. He had a role in the Qana massacre, invaded again in 2006 during Israel's brutal war against Lebanon. So in many ways, he also shows the transnational dimensions of this terrorist regime.
You talked about the Qana massacre, and that was a big one back in 1996, where you had 100 civilians and UN peacekeepers that were involved there in the way that it was carried out. So that kind of fits the description, Tariq, of what you have said and the way that you've described Naftali Bennett. Tell us, if you can, your understanding as to why this coalition that has been formed is so fragile.
Well, the only unification point of this coalition is hate of Netanyahu, the corrupt war criminal, and wanting to dispose with him, because you know, Sagar and Bennett are both lieutenants of Netanyahu, and they are the backbone behind the extremist parties joining Yair Lapid and doing this coalition. But let us remember, as your guest said, there is no difference between left and right in Israel. It's a colonial project. Land grabbing was done during labor governments more than it was done in Likud governments. Palestinians were killed at the hands of labor governments as much as they were killed in Likud governments. they are just trying to appease their crowds by adding more to their resume and their CVs. The number of Palestinian casualties, the number of massacres that they have committed. This is how you advance in the Zionist politics. So it's a race between two war criminals or a contest between two criminals. And if you remember that famous scene in Sheikh Jarrah, Bun al-Kurd's house, when this chap, the Zionist, I don't call them settlers, they are land grabbers and thieves, came to Bun al-Kurd's house and she told him, you are stealing my house. He said, if I don't steal it, somebody else will steal it. And the difference between Netanyahu and Bennett is if Bennett, Netanyahu doesn't kill Palestinians, then Naftali Bennett will kill more.
Uh-huh.
That's the rate in Zionist politics, and this is their project. Look at his party manifesto. Advancement of land grabbing. I don't call them settlements. They are illegal outposts and land grabbing. They are under international law, a crime against international law, and they are not recognized by any government. While we hear lip service from the United States and the European Union about two-state solution, his manifesto is grabbing all land in what is called land C or
okay.
Area C of the Oslo Agreement. He is determined and show the ugliness of the Jewish law that's passed as Israel as a Jewish state in Jerusalem. He has approved the march, what's called the flag march, which
right.
the even Netanyahu postponed because he know what it will lead to tomorrow. It's the march at 6:30 from Bab al-Amud in Jerusalem, the flag march, and it will be a hot flashpoint because Palestinians and Jerusalemites will fight for their rights.
Right.
They are freedom-loving people. They are entitled to that by international law and
okay.
by all freedom-loving people.
Let me ask Daniel about this march, which is said to be one of the first tests, Daniel Yejic, that Naftali Bennett is going to have to face. Based on what our guest there said, if once this march takes place and if there's going to be anything that's going to happen during this march, which all signs are pointing that it will, how do you think Naftali Bennett is going to handle it?
It has been going on so far as well. This is, again, not an exception. It's just another way of for Zionists to show their presence in Jerusalem in illegally in territories that are illegally occupied under international law. And all of these provocations and manifestations of the settler colonial regime, of course, are what Israel is all about. It's very closely connected to the idea of expanding the settlements and effectively just trying to physically take away the space from Palestinians in any way possible, be it by kicking them out of their homes, protesting with in front of them. So it would definitely be another way for Bennett to consolidate his power amongst his voters, which again are effectively, even if the ideological streams within them are might be different, but it goes back to the same structure, which is a colonialist and supremacist one that oppresses and suppresses Palestinians and sees them as less than human and as people who are not deserving of human rights or living in their homes.
Tariq, some of the objectives by Naftali Bennett, based on the types of actions that he's participated in, it includes not ruling out a Palestinian state. He wants to maintain ultimate control over all the land, and he is known as a settler leader, and he's called for Israel to be more forceful when it comes to attacks on the Gaza Strip, which are some of the things that you have said. Now, what's very interesting is that that's his resume, that's his report card, and yet you have the congratulatory messages coming through. Well, the U.S. doesn't count, really. I mean, the U.S. already is the staunchest ally. But, you know, when it comes from the EU or from European countries, such as the European Council president, that he was looking forward to strengthening the EU-Israel partnership, isn't that a way just reconfirming the actions, which are illegal, that Naftali Bennett is going to be doing now that he's in that position as Prime Minister?
Well, the whole colonial project is legal under international law. And if you go back to the International Court of Justice rulings and the Security Council and the United Nations General Council, there are so many decisions which have been taken, and they were stopped by the United States veto. Biden took office and says he wants peace and he wants two-state solution, which is a mirage now and just a lip talk. The same day he said this, he provided the Zionist entity with $735 million of new hardware to attack Gaza. They have attacked Gaza, an open prison which is just 300 kilometers. And Gaza used to be a beach resort. All those people who are living in Gaza and cramped in this open prison are the refugees who came from Ashkelon, Ashkelon and Ashdod and the area surrounding Gaza, what is called the Southern Belt. These people, the Zionist entity has thrown death, destruction, disease, deprivation and degradation on the Palestinians, and to no avail, because the majestic capital defiance, the majestic capital D of defiance, the Palestinian defiance will swallow all of that. And I can see very soon that the Sun of Freedom will rise on the children of Gaza, will rise on the children of Palestine, will rise on the children of Jerusalem and a free Palestine. No matter changing faces, Bennett, Netanyahu, the colonial Zionist project is collapsing and it carries inside itself, like this government, the roots of its destruction, because it is against international law, it's against humanity, and it's against faith, including Judaism. Look at the people of La Torre Carta heading the marches in Brooklyn, New York, carrying "Say No to Zionism." We want Palestine to be completely free. These are Jews who are embracing true Judaism. We have no problem with Judaism.
Right.
It's this colonial land grabbing, ethnic cleansing, murderer ideology that we're facing, and we will break it.
So, Daniel, let's at least look at what has unfolded here. I mean, after all, 12 years of Netanyahu, the world was accustomed to what he was doing in the occupied territories. Any chance that there's going to be a push of any kind coming through, not from the U.S., but from any other countries in particular, from the EU, for example, that perhaps they're going to push Naftali Bennett into stopping some of the violations taking place in occupied territories. I mean, Naftali Bennett was in his previous post as Minister of Military Affairs, so one way or another he was involved in this 11-day war. One way or another he's involved with the decision-making that took place in terms of settlements, et cetera, even though he wasn't prime minister at the time. Do you think there's a chance that there may be a change there?
The emergence now of Bennett as the new prime minister has just given the European Union yet another chance to whitewash Israel's crimes and those of its politicians on their behalf. It is quite interesting that Bennett is, in his rhetoric, rather open about his hatred of Palestinians, about supporting all sorts of human rights violations and violations of international law, including the expansion of settlements, which the European Union is, at least on paper, opposed to, and at the same time gets praise from European Union unelected bureaucrats as well as politicians who have sent all sorts of enthusiastic messages today, looking forward to deepening their ties with Israel and so on. And even this EU commissioner for the what they call Middle East peace process has said that he looks forward to working towards peace, and it's very detached from the actual situation on the ground. There is no peace process, and Bennett would probably be the last who would support such a step. So here, it is just another occasion for the European Union to show what a failure it actually is and its policies and its presence in Palestine, and through its non-existent approach towards Palestinians actually facilitates the expansion of Israeli violence and violations of international law on behalf of Israel, while not doing that as openly. But I think so. Definitely, there's not going to be any shift in their rhetoric or any actions.
Okay. And final question, Tariq, to you. Palestinian Prime Minister has come out and made a couple statements here, saying one of them, that the ousting of Netanyahu closes one of the worst periods of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. How was it one of the worst periods, especially when his predecessors have been accused of the same?
Yes. And Netanyahu was the longest-serving prime minister, and he presided over many massacres of Palestinians and many land grabbing, and his premiership has been marred by the blood of innocent Palestinians. People killed at checkpoints, pregnant ladies cannot go to hospitals. The destruction of the whole health care system in Gaza. They said that we left Gaza. Gaza has been under siege for 12 years now. They control everything, the sea. They don't let boats fish around Gaza. They control anything. Gaza is under siege for 12 years. Imagine that, 2 million people living in an open prison. So Netanyahu, Bennett, Perez, they are just names to a long list of war criminals in a colonial, racist, narcissist, blood superiority
right.
over others. And this is totally unacceptable, by the way. And by the way, for the European Union is a toothless power. They can solve the problem of Northern Ireland, not the problem the solve of solving the problem of the worst racist ethnic cleansing occupation in the
okay.
whole world.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it, Tariq Tahboub. From Amman, political analyst, and Daniel Yejic, thank you, author and researcher from Beirut. With that, we come to an end. This edition of The Debate from Mikhail Tagway, entire team of the Capital Tehran is goodbye.